From the studios of 88.9 KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Barbara Stanwyck occupies an elite place in the history of American cinema. Only Bette Davis, Joan Crawford, and Katharine Hepburn had careers like Stanwyck's, which spanned the decades with great work in a wide range of roles, in a variety of genres, and with the industry's greatest directors. But Barbara Stanwyck was sort of the Rodney Dangerfield of this elite group. She didn't get no respect. She never won a competitive Oscar. She was not heralded as great during her career. My guest, Dan Callahan, has written the first major critical biography of this great star. The book is called Barbara Stanwyck, The Miracle Woman. Dan Callahan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much for having me.
Why do you think there's been a sort of a neglect of Barbara Stanwyck and her work?
I think the main reason is that she was not all that great with publicity. She was not someone who was comfortable when she was older going on television and doing talk shows, whereas, you know, Katharine Hepburn and Bette Davis were very, very good at that. They themselves both wrote memoirs of their own, and they were very savvy about publicity. I think Stanwyck was not as savvy about it, and she was a little shy. She thought, you know, she didn't have a big education, and so she liked to stay away from publicity. I really think that that's a huge reason why she wasn't as well known as they.
Well, like them, she had sort of distinct phases in her career, and she was able to move from one phase to the next with pretty much ease, which nowadays most actresses, I guess Meryl Streep is the exception, who can do that. So let's talk a little bit about those phases. At first, there was the, I guess, what we now call the pre-code years and the Frank Capra years. Talk a little bit about how she got into film and those early
roles.
Sure.
She followed her first husband, Frank Fay, out to Hollywood. He had signed a contract with Warner Brothers. He was a big vaudeville star at that time. She had done some work as a chorus girl and had starred in a play or two on Broadway, and so she came out there with him. She had a hard time at first in talking pictures. She made two pictures in a row that did not go well at all. They're both very poor pictures. Then her third movie, she worked with Frank Capra, and it was called Ladies of Leisure, 1930, and Frank Capra fell just madly in love with her. And then that movie really made her a star, and then subsequent films with him kind of consolidated her stardom. And I think the relationship between Capra and Stanwyck is one of the great director-star pairings in cinema. Because it's that kind of thing where the director, you can tell that the director is in love with the actress and is doing everything he can to present her in the best possible way and the most interesting possible way.
When you say he fell in love with Barbara Stanwyck, Frank Capra fell in love with Barbara Stanwyck, do you believe that they fell in love, well, at least he fell in love with her in a romantic way, or just as a director for her, for his actress?
He admitted very frankly in his autobiography that he fell in love with her, you know, madly in love with her, and that she was married to Frank Fay at that time, and he waited for her. And I think he wanted to leave Frank Fay because Frank Fay was a very abusive man. He drank. His career didn't go well as the years went on, and hers was going up. It was like the classic A Star Is Born situation. And so he waited for her, but it seems to me she didn't say anything about it herself. But it seems to me that she was fine with his adoration as long as they were making these beautiful films together. I don't know if she felt the same way that he did about her, but he said that, you know, he finally, when he knew that he couldn't have Barbara Stanwyck, he married his wife Lou, and so that's what happened in that situation. But he was really in love with her, and it shows on screen.
And he also says in his book, The Name Above the Title, that Barbara Stanwyck was best in a first take. And that was sort of what he felt was the secret to filming Barbara Stanwyck.
Yes, and he would rehearse the other actors in the scene, and he wouldn't have her rehearse. And then he would come in, she would come in, and she would do it. And he would make sure that, you know, that hopefully they wouldn't have to do it again. Because she had a thing that she needed to believe that it was actually happening. And if you asked her to do it again, right away, second or third time, for whatever reason, that screwed up her belief in it. Like she needed to believe it was happening right in the moment, and she didn't have that technical thing of some actors are very, as I say in the book, are very good at that. They get better as they do more takes, 6, 7, 8 takes. She one take. That's the I think that's part of why she's so fresh and so good. You know, I think as she got older, she was able to adapt, and if she had to do a bunch of takes, she was able to. But she always would prefer to do that one take to be fresh.
And now we always refer to that era of the pre-code before the motion picture production code was strictly enforced in 1934-35. And she made a lot of successful films then. What are some of those great ones?
Well, Babyface certainly is a notorious film where she plays this girl from the wrong side of the tracks who goes into this big city and sleeps her way in a bank from floor by floor. Every time she makes a conquest of a man, the camera goes up another floor. And, I mean, they make no bones about the fact that she's using her body to get ahead. And there are several other films. There's a film called Illicit, where she's kind of living in sin with her boyfriend. And there, after 1934, you would never have something like that. And you know, if she is a prostitute in one of her films, they call it a dance hall girl, like in 10 Cents a Dance, her film that Lionel Barrymore directed. But it's a very, you know, it's frank, it's very frank, and it suits her frankness too to be so frank about sex. Her Stanwyck and sex is a very interesting subject, and a very interesting tension in all of her films, but certainly in the pre-code films, very interesting. And Babyface is probably the most interesting of them all on that level.
Well, since you brought up sex, I was never going to bring that up, Dan Callahan.
Well,
that was never. But anyway, since you happen to bring it up, one of my guests here on From the Bookshelf a while back was Robert Wagner, and he told us that that he and Barbara Stanwyck that he lived with her for a while, and that although they kept their relationship confidential, but he did say she was good.
Well, I think that I'm happy that he's been forthcoming about that, and I hope that it does seem as if, you know, that secret relationship with him did kind of shore up her confidence, because she had not had, her two marriages were both very, very bad marriages, and for drastically different reasons. Frank Fay dominated her and slapped her around and drank too much and was just awful to her. And when she divorced him, she was with Robert Taylor, and that, it was the opposite. She was a little bossy with him, and he finally had to leave, and she really, a lot of people say, she never got over that. It's a complicated thing. But so the fact that she had Robert Wagner for a while is quite a nice thing, you know, for her, certainly.
In your book, in your book, you also kind of mention in passing, or kind of vague about some kind of a relationship with Al Jolson, the great popular vocalist and stage star and star of The Jazz Singer.
I believe that she told Robert Wagner something to the effect that he had been very cruel to her when she was a chorus girl. And, you know, of course, he was, you know, like Frank Fay, he was even bigger than Frank Fay. He was the biggest, you know, name at that time in show business. And so something happened with him when she was a chorus girl. She alluded to it to Robert Wagner and to some other people, but I think she didn't say exactly what happened. But she did say that he treated her very poorly for whatever reason. So it's unfortunate. she did not have the best luck when it came to encounters with men.
After her marriage with Robert Taylor, she never married again?
No, she did not. She had a few friends, and she had her work was the most important thing to her. She wanted to be the best of all, is what she said. And I think that really she accomplished that goal. And if that meant her personal life was put on the back burner, then that's what that meant. You know, certainly what she had of a personal life was usually not very happy. And so to focus on work is probably a smart and wary thing to do.
We're talking with Dan Callahan, and he's just written a great book about Barbara Stanwyck called The Miracle Woman. And there's a kind of a ugly side to the story revealed in your book, and that is her kind of careless adoption of a son, and then she kind of tossed him aside when she was lost interest.
Well,
it's kind of how it sounds.
What happened is she was trying to make the marriage with Frank Fay work, and so they adopted a boy, Dion, and after that marriage was over, he was kind of a problem child, and he didn't get good grades, and he wasn't around. And so she sort of pushed herself away. She sent him off to military school, and the thing about him is, when she really was done with him, is that he got in trouble with the law in 1960, and he was arrested for selling pornographic materials to teenagers. And this embarrassed her. It was really, really embarrassed her. So to the point that if her friends mentioned him, she would just say, oh, he's long since gone, and they would just have to change the subject. She wouldn't even talk about him. So it was, I don't know. I've given this some thought, and certainly, I don't know if it's worse, like someone like Crawford and Christina Crawford, her daughter, is someone who's actively cruel, or Stanley wasn't cruel, she just kind of got rid of him. I don't know if that's worse than I don't think it's worse than being actively cruel. I think in a way, it just didn't work, and she wasn't going to put in the, and she knew it, she couldn't make it work, and so she just cut ties. She didn't try to make it work and have it, you know, turn into a horrible mess or something. She put his picture in her closet. She didn't have pictures of him around. She kept the picture, but you know, she just left it there. So.
Did she remember him in her will or anything like that?
No. Actually, when she was in the hospital, she left strict instructions that he was not to be let in to her room. So she didn't want anything financial, anything at all. I think she really hardened her heart against him and just didn't want to deal with it. So, you know, we can judge, but she didn't have parents herself. She didn't know what being a parent was. She was an orphan when she was a little girl in Brooklyn. So
maybe we don't have all the information in that story.
Yeah.
So let's talk about her films. So after the kind of the pre-code era, that's when she kind of developed a flair for comedy.
Yes. She herself said that she was not a funny person, and that she could only really be funny if she had a script that was wonderfully written, like The Lady Eve, the Preston Sturges film. And I think that is true. I think that's something she really had to, she had a wonderful script. She would push herself, but I think it was true. She was a very serious person, and she had a kind of sadness about her and a kind of dignity. So for her to be funny, it was really stretching. It was a real stretch for her to do that. And the fact that she's able to do that and succeed in, say, The Lady Eve or Ball of Fire, it really says a lot about her that she's able to do that. Because there are a lot of actors who are wonderful at one or the other, drama or comedy, but there are a lot of actors who can't do both. She's at her best in drama, but she did some terrific comedies too, and it was hard for her, I think, to do, but also very rewarding for her too, certainly in The Lady Eve, where she had a wonderful time. And if you remember the great scene where she's seducing Henry Fonda at the last for 2 or 3 minutes, she was famous, as we were talking about, for doing just a single take and for being the professional, never muffing a line, never doing. But when she was seducing Henry Fonda in The Lady Eve, she would break up laughing all the time, and I think that was very unusual for her to do that. But I think that's part of how she had to get into that. And it's wonderful to see her stretching herself in that way. And that's part of what makes that movie wonderful and what makes Barbara Stanwyck in comedy so wonderful.
Well, we're talking with Dan Callahan, and his latest book is called Barbara Stanwyck, The Miracle Woman. Stanwyck starred in one of the great film noirs, maybe the first kind of real film noir, and that was Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity, written by Raymond Chandler. You don't particularly like that picture.
It's not that I don't like it. I'm ambivalent about it. I think it's for her. It's in relation to her. It's kind of a tricky movie thing, a lot of people have complained about that strange wig that she's wearing in the film. That's part of it. But certainly the classic moment when McMurray strangles her husband and Billy Wilder gives her that close-up where she's so satisfied, that's one of Stanwyck's great moments. You know, I think if you I go into a little detail in my book about the book that it was adapted from, in that book she's playing a serial killer, basically, and that was a new kind of idea of a sociopath in 1944. And I mean, even though she is very impressive in that, I think that there are other films slightly underrated that I just personally prefer and wanted to call attention to, like, say, the Douglas Sirk movie, All I Desire, which is kind of difficult to see, but it's one of her very best and most emotional performances. Have you seen that film?
Yes. And yeah. You think Sirk was good at bringing the best out of Stanwyck?
I do think so, yes. I think there's something that he gave her that she's very exposed in All I Desire, in a way that I can't think of any other film except maybe some of the early Capra movies. She's so emotionally exposed in the scene where she's the mother and she's been away for years and she goes back to her old house and he gives her a long close-up of looking at the house. And as I say in the book, it's like she's taking all the masks off that she wears and you just see everything. It's almost an emotionally pornographic moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that movie, I really do wish it was more available and more seen and spoken about, because it's just, I think that and Capra's The Bitter Tea of General Yen are the two that just are kind of shining at the top of her career for me.
Well, fortunately, The Bitter Tea of General Yen is now available.
Yeah.
I think the Turner Classic Movies Vault has a box set of Capras that includes that. But the Douglas Sirk's still not out there yet.
Yeah, no, and the other one she made with him, They're Always Tomorrow, which is pretty much Fred McMurray's picture, but she's awfully good in that, too. So it would be very nice if those two films could be put out. Your Criterion has put out The Furies, which is an amazing film.
Yeah, no, we haven't talked about her westerns. Let's move into the westerns. Yes, The Furies, directed by Anthony Mann, was one of her great westerns, and she made quite a few westerns.
Oh, yeah, she herself, she lived on a ranch with Robert Taylor. She was from Brooklyn and these cramped tenements, and when she was in Hollywood, she loved the open air, and she bred horses with Zeppel Marx for the Marx Brothers, and she loved westerns most of all. She loved being out and doing stunts. In the Sam Fuller movie, 40 Guns, which is really her last great movie as a star, 1957, she herself does a stunt in that movie where Fuller wanted her character to be dragged across the plain, and her foot's in the stirrup of a horse. And a stunt person was going to do it, but they wanted to control the drag so that they could get their foot out of the stirrup if they wanted to. And Fuller said, it'll look fake if you do it like that. And they said, well, we're not doing it. And so Stanwyck heard it, and she said, I'll do it. And so in that film, you see her 50 years old being dragged across the plain by this horse in a tornado, and, you know, she's really doing it. It's a little bit like Lillian Gish in Way Down East or something.
On the ice floe.
Putting her whole body on the line, everything on the line for a movie.
Yeah, well, westerns were always a part of her career, even back in the 1930s, and she was, I think, maybe her first big western was Union Pacific, but I guess she was in Annie Oakley even before that, right?
Yeah, Annie Oakley is a kind of western, I think. So, I mean, I include that in my western chapter. And, yeah, Union Pacific is a real western kind of adventure sort of film. Directed by Cecil B. DeMille.
Yeah.
And California, the John Farrow film in Technicolor, has some interesting things in it. So there's a lot of interesting westerns with her. But the two great ones are the neurotic westerns of the 50s, The Furies, directed by Anthony Mann, and the one I was talking about earlier, The 40 Guns, 1967. Those are the ones where she really just... The Furies, she has two wonderful actors to play off of, Walter Huston and Judith Anderson, and so that really ups her game in a lot of ways.
Yes, it's a great film. And Walter Huston, who had just I think the movie before The Furies was The Treasure of Sierra Madre, where he plays a kind of a little guy, and here he is in The Furies playing, you know, this gigantic guy. It's kind of
It's a big Shakespearean sort of performance, and Judith Anderson is giving this big Shakespearean sort of performance, and Anthony Mann is directing it brilliantly, and the cinematography is terrific, and and there's a very famous scene in it that if you haven't seen it, we don't want to spoil it, but it involves Stanwyck and a pair of scissors.
Right, exactly. You know, and that's actually a question I have in your book. You know, you do tell everything, you know, when you're talking about your films, her films. And yet, you know, part of your book, and you stated in your foreword, is that you want people to be aware of Stanwyck and see her films more. So is there a way to talk about films without giving away their endings in a book?
I think actually that ideally what I wanted is hopefully you have access to some of these films, and you can kind of sort of read along as you're watching them or rewatching them. And I think it maybe isn't the most ideal thing in the world to read the book before you've seen, you know, all these movies, because I do discuss them in depth. I do discuss, say, The Furies and what happens with the scissors, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the kind of thing that I had hoped that perhaps if you're interested in her, that you would watch or rewatch the films and kind of, you know, argue with me or go back and forth with me about it in your own head and kind of solidify your own ideas about her work by reading the book and watching the film.
No, okay. I get to actually argue with you, not in my head, but here we are on the telephone together. Sometimes it seems to me that you don't care for her most famous works, like I mentioned, Double Indemnity. But, you know, I think a lot of baby boomers love her because they knew her from The Big Valley, a Western television series that she starred in the 1960s. You don't like The Big Valley?
No. And the thing is that, and I understand that because I know, like, my parents are baby boomer generation, and I think they first knew her through The Big Valley. And I didn't really... Like, when I was a kid, I saw Double Indemnity and The Lady Eve and her great feature film. And really, The Big Valley I didn't really see until I was working on the book. And so the thing is, like, I did it kind of in chronological order, and so I was watching all of the films. And then, so when I got to the show, I think it's funny when you put things in a certain context, you can see, like, things either go up or go down, or, you know, if you're, like, you say you're comparing something to The Furies or All I Desire or Double Indemnity, suddenly the television show, the look of it and what it gives her to do, it just isn't as interesting, or it wasn't as interesting for me.
Well, I can understand that, but if you were like me and were watching it when it was actually on TV, it was great. It was a good show. It was a good show compared to, you know, Flipper. No, I kind of like Flipper. But, you know, some of the things that were on maybe weren't as good as the
book. You know, actually, there's a really good episode of that show with Charles Bronson, if you remember. They get trapped under, there's kind of an explosion, and they get trapped under a church. And she has this fantastic moment with Charles Bronson where he's kind of whining. And she says something like, "Oh, grow up!" And it's great to see, you know, this kind of, you know, she was still very petite and everything, just telling this big hulking tough man to go grow, toughen up, grow up. We'll get out of here. You know, there are a few good episodes of Nick Malley. I just, when I was watching it, there's a lot of episodes where, like, I really don't care about the children. Like,
yeah.
And so when she isn't involved, I would, you know, my attention would wander when she was, and I just wanted her to be front and center all the time. And she is, say, in that Charles Bronson episode.
Right. Yes. It was an ensemble show, and there was never enough of Miss Barbara Stanwyck on the show.
It's true.
I want to ask you also about a movie that you put down in your book, and that's the movie Roustabout. Not only do you put Roustabout down, but you also said that I can't quote you exactly, but it was something like part of the depressing programming that they air once a year on Elvis Presley's birthday.
Or just when they do the Elvis movies back to back, which they like TNT used to do at TCM.
Yeah,
it's just it's the way it happens a lot.
Yes, no, it does, and I can say freely that there are many of the 31 movies that Elvis made that are not that great, but there are some that are really wonderful, and one of them that I've always loved is Roustabout because it has Barbara Stanwyck in it.
Well, as I say in the book, she has that one really good scene with them where she's kind of talking sense to him. It's sort of like the Charles Bronson thing, where he's being a little self-involved, and she says, no, you can't, you've got to think about other people. You can't just think about yourself all the time. And it's this great meeting of, hey, Elvis isn't quite baby boomer, but a little bit, with this kind of gritty 1920s, 1930s, tough depression sort of thing, which is all about not being self-involved, thinking about other people, being tough. And so that collision in the movie, in that one scene, really is quite nice and quite interesting.
In the end of Barbara Stanwyck's life, she finally did kind of get some recognition. There was the American Film Institute and finally an Academy Award, Lifetime Achievement Award. That was kind of an emotional moment you talk about in your book quite well.
Yeah, she got the Oscar 1982. And she gave a very good speech. She was very happy to be doing it. The American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award was a little further down the line when she wasn't able to actually sit at the table. She had hurt her back. She had bad back all of her life because a horse kicked her when they were shooting a movie called Forbidden, the Frank Capra movie. And it was just a little scene on a beach, and she had to spend the rest of the movie going to the hospital at night and being in traction. And all of her life, just for that one little scene on the beach, the horse had kicked her, and she had a bad back all of her life. So it had caught up with her at that point when she when they gave her the American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award. But also a lot of her co-stars weren't around. I think the one really great co-star that was around that could pay tribute to her was Fred McMurray. And when I was writing the book, it really was interesting to me that three of her very best movies, Double Indemnity, If There's Always Tomorrow, and Remember the Night, all of them co-star Fred McMurray. And Fred McMurray is really, if I had to pick a co-star to get the most out of her, it would be him. And no one ever talks about Fred McMurray as being any great kind of great actor, but he certainly is terrific in Double Indemnity and in There's Always Tomorrow.
I do think he was a good actor. I think he was one of those actors that was able to become a star because all of the real movie stars went off to war during World War II. And that's kind of when he rose up, and I think he made quite a few good movies and a lot of good westerns, and he's in the Caine Mutiny. But then, I think, he did some Disney movies, and then My Three Sons.
And then he was on that television show, Billy Wilder gave him a good shot in The Apartment.
Oh, that's right, The Apartment. Let's not forget that one, yeah. Well, listen, the book is called Barbara Stanwyck, The Miracle Woman. The author, Dan Callahan, this is your first book?
Yes, it is.
But not your last. You got more coming. What's coming next, Dan?
I'm working on a book about Vanessa Redgrave right now.
Oh, good. Good. Well, I hope you'll come back and visit us on From the Bookshelf when it's ready.
I would be happy to.
Thanks for spending some time with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, that closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. Subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Dan Callahan, his new book, Barbara Stanwyck, The Miracle Woman. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.